And we're back here on Unusual Sources, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial and the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca, which is our online streaming service. Very pleased today to have a repeat guest, which is Murray Dobbin, and he is a BC-based author, commentator, writes for a number of publications such as Counterpunch, which is one of our favorites. He's on his own website, murraydobbin.ca, which I highly encourage you to visit, and we'll be providing a link to that online. I want to say, yeah, Murray, thanks very much for joining us today.
Happy to do it.
I thought your article was very important because Canada seems to be on the front lines on this issue with regard to Russia and Eastern Europe and the European Union. You wrote an article posted on June 24th, which is called "As NATO Warmongering Against Russia Intensifies, Canada Faces a Difficult Choice." I thought that came along at a very important time. You pointed out there's a summit coming up, there's talks coming up. I guess you're probably feeling the same sentiment as I am, which is, you know, that things have really declined in international relations since the end of the Cold War in some respects, because, you know, we were supposed to have a peace dividend, an era of peace, nuclear disarmament. At least those sentiments were out there in the optimistic, heady early 1990s for some people. But none of those things seem to have happened. And now we're facing down Russia again. I don't know if it's more of a tragedy or more of a farce or what, but you've pointed out newspaper reporting and other reporting is talking about an expansionist and imperialist Russia. And it seems more than a little disingenuous coming from NATO and Washington. So you say that Russia seems to be reacting to U.S. and NATO provocations that are inflaming the situation. And I'm just wondering if you could tell us, you know, what is it you think our media is ignoring or downplaying when it's talking about a specifically a Russian threat?
Well, I think they're ignoring everything. I mean, they're ignoring all the developments, and specifically, they're ignoring the history of this development, and that's one of the things that I tried to focus on in my column. Is that, you know, foreign policy is always complex. It always depends on people understanding the context for whatever is happening. I mean, this does nothing in foreign affairs. You know, starts from scratch. There's always a long historical record of relationships between countries that need to be understood for the present to be understood. And the context here is a meeting between Mikhail Gorbachev and James Baker, who was the Secretary of State for the U.S. at the time in February 1990, which was just preceded the dismantlement of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. And the Warsaw Pact was a military pact with the communist equivalent to NATO, and Gorbachev agreed to disband both those on a handshake with Baker, promising, and this was extremely important to Gorbachev. I mean, this was the deal breaker. Baker said, "We will not expand NATO one inch to the east," and of course, NATO really, why NATO even existed after 1990 is a puzzle, given that its sole purpose was as a bulwark against communism. But in any case, Gorbachev knew that NATO was going to continue. And after that, I mean, NATO did expand to the east. It expanded to, you know, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Romania, Poland. I mean, all these countries are now part of NATO and getting closer, you know, obviously closer. Those three small countries are right on the border of Russia. Russia quite reasonably saw this as a threat and a complete breakdown in trust between the U.S. and Russia. And throughout this period, and I actually didn't mention this in the column, but throughout this period, Putin, who is demonized all the time, has constantly been trying to establish better relations with the West, and actually has requested initially to be part of NATO, so that if there's a security agreement in Europe, he said Russia should be part of it. So rather than being hostile to the West, Russia has made an effort to reconcile and has wanted to become a part of Europe. But the door has been slammed in its face constantly, mostly by the United States, which completely dominates NATO. So that's the context for all of this. And either the media has no clue about the context, or is lazy, or is complicit in, you know, in this effort to provoke Russia.
Yeah, I mean, they're trying to make it look like it's almost a replay of some aspects of World War II. You know, Russia's got thousands of tanks on the border just gunning to overrun all of Europe. And meanwhile, it ignores the history of the last 20 years, as you pointed out. It seemed like hardly a day goes by in the last 20 years or more where Russia wasn't trying to create some new trade agreement or some new diplomatic arrangement, even in the last 5 years when things have been tense. Russia had all these trade deals and agreements and energy deals with Europe, with Germany, industrial subcontracting deals, real economic arrangements, and they wanted to get closer and more integrated. And as you point out, the U.S. doesn't seem too happy with that. Russia, if I recall correctly, it did ask for entry into NATO, didn't it?
It did, exactly. And now, of course, Russia has said, well, obviously, this is a non-starter, and so they've been working extremely closely, you know, basically since the crisis in the Ukraine, working closely with China and looking at constructing what they've called the New Silk Road and building an enormous, economic growth between Russia and China and the countries in between. So we've essentially, I mean, the U.S., which now also considers China an enemy, as if they don't have enough enemies. So they've essentially driven Russia into the arms of China, their other supposed enemy. So instead of working towards reconciliation and building Russia into a Europe that could see future growth, they've essentially abandoned Russia, demonized it, and strengthened its alleged enemy in China, because that's now where most of Russia's natural gas is going to go.
Yes, it's all very pathetic. And everyone that's been seriously evaluating the situation has said exactly what you're saying, which is that the United States via NATO has been closing Russia off from Europe and driving Russia and China closer together. We can look at that as to why the U.S. might want to do that. But I noticed that your article actually listed even further provocations. I mean, beyond moving NATO closer to Russia, because that's what's been happening in the last 20 years, not so much vice versa, but NATO moving closer to Russia. There's been things like this anti-ballistic missile, so-called shield defense, whatever. What's going on with that?
Well, it's, you know, it's a farce. And there was an interesting article on the I can't remember the website. I'll send it to you if I can find it. But it was an article pointing out that these so-called anti-ballistic missile arrays can be quickly and seamlessly changed into offensive weapons, so that they could be used offensively against Russia. I mean, the main thing is that these are enormously destabilizing. Any technology that attempts to neutralize the Russian nuclear capability creates instability. I mean, what we had all these years was called MAD, of course, mutually assured destruction. So that the fact that both these countries had enormous stockpiles of nuclear weapons meant that they wouldn't be used, because if one side attacked, then the other would literally vaporize the other enemy. So as soon as you start to interfere in that strategic balance of nuclear weapons, you create enormous instability. And it would be like suddenly Russia had a treaty with Mexico and set up anti-ballistic missile sites on the border of Mexico.
Yeah.
It really is madness. You really have to wonder how the U.S. military can have this much power. But if you look at the military-industrial complex, I mean, it's really the only industrial part of the United States that's left. They have essentially contracted out most of their manufacturing to China and other Asian countries. So the military production it has become extremely important in the U.S. just in terms of industrial jobs. So the military-industrial complex is alive and well. And that seems to explain this whole thing. I mean, the United States military needs an enemy. ISIS isn't quite the enemy it had in mind. It doesn't know how to deal with with that enemy that they, of course, that's another whole topic for discussion. They created that enemy. But they seem to need a constant supply of enemies, and Russia is obviously on the list.
Well, you've given us about two motivations for the behavior of the United States and NATO so far, and I think they're ones that have been fairly widely discussed. The first is control over Europe. Control over the European Union. The EU is a body through which bureaucratic institutions can rule over a bunch of countries, and NATO is there. You know, as the old saying goes, you've heard it before, you'll hear it again. The purpose of NATO is to keep the Germans down, the Russians out, and the U.S. in. And so that's being expanded all over Europe, so that Europe is a sort of area that's subordinate to the United States in many respects and would follow their economic direction. They don't like Russia, getting in there. So that's one thing. And then the need for a military enemy with the stature of the Soviet Union or something resembling it in some capacity, because that is the major industry, it seems.
And of course the other side of that, as you were pointing out, is Europe itself, and that's the European Commission, which is the economic arm of the European Union, an extremely right wing organization that is behind the policies of austerity and debt reduction and the cutting back of social programs, the crippling policies that the European Commission has tried to impose on member countries like Greece. Interesting that just as a side note, Brexit is extremely worrying to the U.S. because Brexit really undermines NATO and it undermines the European Commission. Britain has always been America's strongest ally in NATO and in the European Commission, and all of a sudden it's going to be out. So that'll be really interesting to watch. I think that's, from my perspective, from a geopolitical perspective, I think Brexit is really positive because it undermines a Europe completely dominated by the U.S., and you could actually see, although there's no doubt there is an issue of xenophobia and right-wing nationalism, there's also the issue of globalization. If France and Germany exit the European Commission, then you actually have nation states that need to deal with national policy and building their own nations, which I think could be really interesting.
Well, that's a very big issue that underlies this whole thing, which is that in Europe, in the European Union, that whole region, there's always been a strong sentiment for social democracy, for social spending, welfare states, unionization, union participation in government, that sort of thing, economic nationalism, local production. And in a U.S.-dominated EU, you don't see very much of that. You just see the globalization, neoliberalism.
Exactly, and these trade deals. I mean, the other positive thing about Brexit, I think the CETA deal with between Europe and Canada and the TTIP so-called trade deal, they're actually investment protection agreements. But these two agreements, I think, are dead without Britain. And there's already enormous opposition to them in France and Germany and other countries. So, at this point, I see nothing but positive things coming out of Brexit.
Well, there's this very unfortunate element of xenophobia that you pointed out, and I think what the European Union does, when you have austerity policies that are pursued by unelected bureaucrats in Brussels and elsewhere, when you're cutting back people's health care and education, it turns into a sort of dog-eat-dog mentality. And I think that, the EU has been promoted as being against racism, but it's actually been generating racism. And the EU has been promoted as giving peace, to Europe. But where's the peace? Look what's happening with Russia right now, never mind countries in the Middle East that the EU is involved in. And I sort of wanted to return to that, actually, because the EU has not been a bulwark for peace so much, and it's allowed this ABM system that you mentioned, which, if I've done some reading on that, it's my recollection that they first tried to justify these ABM systems by saying that they were to defend against Iran.
Exactly. Well, that threat's now disappeared. So
everyone laughed at that at the time because they knew it wasn't for Iranian missiles.
Right.
And now, yeah, so they say, okay, well, it's to deal with Russia. And as you said, those missiles can allegedly be repurposed as offensive weapons from the same launcher. It's very dangerous. But it undermines that whole strategic balance you pointed out, where there was at least some kind of balance and no one would want to shoot. But now they're trying to say, well, we're going to get the upper hand, which increases our likelihood of shooting. And it goes hand in hand with the modernization of nuclear weapons that you also wrote about, wherein officials are saying that they're making nuclear weapons smaller and more thinkable. What does that mean exactly?
Well, if you have a smaller weapon and there's less radioactivity, which is what they claim for this new weapon, then you're much more likely to use it. I mean, if you have a 12 megaton bomb, that will, if you use that bomb, you would no doubt start a nuclear war with Russia. But you can just see the military minds working well. If we just use a small one, like a 50 kiloton bomb, as a tactical weapon, then we'll be able to win a conventional war without creating the conditions for an all-out nuclear war. So it just makes them, and you don't want to give the military mind an opportunity to use these things. I mean, they've been itching to use them ever since they bombed Japan. So now they're making it more possible. So it's just, I think in some ways we're in a more dangerous situation now than we were with the Soviet Union.
No doubt. And that atomic clock has been pushed forward, the one that says we're 5 minutes a minute. It's been, we're at Cold War Reagan levels right now, thanks to all this. And I wish I could say that you were exaggerating and that this was all exaggerated nonsense. But unfortunately, it's true, because if you look at the statements of U.S. officials under the Obama administration, previous administrations, they've been talking about changing their nuclear doctrine towards, a first strike doctrine, or the idea that a nuclear war is winnable. Now, that was considered absolutely insane and dangerous talk during the Cold War, but now it's becoming standardized.
Yeah, and people just sort of ignore it. They think that because the Soviet Union is gone, that the threat is gone. And I think that seems to be the default position of most people if and when they think about the issue. But on Obama, the outrageous thing about Obama getting the Nobel Peace Prize and promising an end to nuclear weapons, he is actually committed to more modernization and more nuclear weapons than any post-war president. So, he's committed, I think, to spending $1 trillion in over the next 20 years modernizing the nuclear force of the United States. So the notion that it was such an outrageous lie to say that he was going to rid the world of nuclear weapons when obviously they had no
intention.
No, he's
done the exact opposite. As you point out, and I'm sorry, it is frustrating if people ignore this, as you say. And now we're getting all these puffed up statements by NATO officers and politicians, they're all beating their chests and going on about what they're going to do about Russia and so on. This is, we're not in the Stone Age with people with bats and clubs beating each other. These are nuclear weapons, and you just need to press a button and they get launched. You don't need to act like a tough guy. You need to act reasonable. And, we heard the most ridiculous statements out of the Harper government, and I hope Trudeau is smarter, but you've pointed out they have a choice, right? I mean, Trudeau, they've been talking about the idea of maybe Russia can be talked with, negotiated with, like they've been trying for the last 20 years on the Russian side. So, I mean, what are our options as Canadian government goes?
Well, I mean, the option is just to say no to NATO and say no, we're not going to contribute troops. We think that now is the time for a greater reconciliation and see what happens. I mean, Canada's its own country, and even, I quoted the German foreign minister. Germany is really uncomfortable with this warmongering against Russia, and has obviously been forced into it to a large extent by the United States, although there's clearly people in German conservative circles that would like to see that as well. Maybe Trudeau has to have a private talk with Merkel and say, can we do something to end this madness? Because I think Merkel actually might be open to that conversation.
Well, the Russians want to trade and they want to have arrangements, diplomatic deals, so we can have that, or we can have Canada, which on the firing line, on the front line of a nuclear World War III, because that's where we are. For a totally senseless war that is basically unnecessary. So
yeah, I mean, I just can't imagine us having troops in Lithuania on the border of Russia. That's just completely insane. I hope. I mean, I know that Trudeau has some good advisors. Let's hope they prevail.
We'll see. Well, I mean, I know you'll be watching this situation. It's not going to just end tomorrow. So hopefully we can get more writing on you. I think you've pretty much been following all the major and main issues of this particular conflict and this crisis. So we'll see how it goes. We need you to keep an eye on the Canadian government for us and tell us what's going on.
I'll do my best.
Well, thanks very much, Murray.
Okay.